Well, welcome to ASI Cast episode 121. And our topic this episode is the newly established Tony Cowling Foundation, which has been set up to work with Cambridge University and SMR to fund research into technologically based innovations in market and social research, which is right up our street. We'll look at what the foundation's aiming to do and how our listeners can help, but the announcement does give us a chance also to reflect on the influence that Tony Cowling had on the research industry we know today. Tony died just over a year ago and was the driving force behind Taylor Nelson, the company that would grow to encompass AGB, Softrest, Gallup, and many other research companies, and would eventually become the global research giant currently known as Kantar. Now, many of our listeners will have worked with Tony or met him over the years, and my guest today, Mike Kirkham, has helped to set up the foundation and is perfectly placed to reflect on Tony's career, both having worked with him professionally as CEO of TNS and as a friend. So welcome to the ASI Cast, Mike.
Thank you very much.
So Mike, in what capacity did you first work with Tony? How did your careers first converge?
Well, I, for some years, for about 20 years, had been working for AGB, which became the largest research company in the UK. And when I was there, it was quite international. But you may recall that it was taken over by Robert Maxwell. And that was a disaster in many ways, not least for those of us who had pensions in the company pension scheme, because they disappeared. And the business went into administration. It was Taylor Nelson who acquired the UK assets of AGB from the Maxwell administrators. And I came along as part of the assets or the liabilities, whichever way you care to look at it. And so that was back in about 1992, I think. So that was my first encounter with him. And Taylor Nelson was a tiny company, really. It was listed on the stock exchange, and its market value, its market capitalization was about £8 million. It was very small. And they needed to raise about £15 million to buy AGB from the Maxwell administrator. And Tony asked me to go and help him go around the institutions, you know, the insurance companies and the financial institutions, to see if we could raise this money. And that's when I first really got to know Tony. We spent a lot of time together, and I found him to be an excellent guy to work with. And his real achievement, I think, looking back, was in turning what originally was a tiny little company. It started by him and Liz Nelson in 1965. And by the time that it was taken over by WPP, it was arguably the largest research business in the world. And it was really Tony who was the driving force behind the creation of that. And if you think about it, in 1965, when he started, research was, the way I like to characterize this, it was done by interviewers who were generally nice middle-class ladies who wore hats and they had clipboards. And they asked questions. And by the time that we got to the size that TNS had become, the industry was very much driven by technology, by modern technologies and the internet. So it had changed, the character of the industry had changed. And Tony was someone who understood and appreciated that. Maybe you'd like me just to talk about what his vision was of what he was trying to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that he left us last year, and even in these crazy and distracting times, though, it did send ripples around the research industry. He clearly, you know, worked with and affected a lot of people and influenced a lot of people's careers. So it'd be good to understand, yeah, what his ethos was, and then we can go on to talk about how that transfers into the foundation itself.
Yeah, well, I think one of the characteristics of Tony was that he had a real understanding of the industry itself, of the market research business. He'd started out as a researcher, and people who worked in the industry knew that, and they knew that he was someone who understood them and understood what they were doing, because he'd written questionnaires, he'd done interviews, he genuinely was a researcher. But he also understood what was driving the growth of demand for market research. Market research was growing continuously throughout that period. And two of the main drivers for it were, first of all, the deregulation that was taking place in many industries. If you think in finance or in utility businesses or in telecommunications, these were all deregulated in the area that you're most familiar with, Richard. In media, again, deregulation led to an explosion of different outlets. When you only have to go back to the 1980s, and there were just four TV stations in the UK, and you know the growth of demand driven by deregulation, combined with technology, was immense. And Tony. It also led, along with the globalization of the world economy, to international demand for research. And Tony realized that if Taylor Nelson was going to be successful, it would have to become an international or global business. And that's really what he did. He turned it from this small boutique based in Epsom, down in Surrey, into a company that had operations in about 75 or 80 countries around the world and employed 15,000 people. And I was reflecting on this the other day, that it's almost impossible to think of any company that was not a client of TNS by that time. In media, for example, obviously there were, in the UK, there was ITV and Sky and the BBC, but there were media companies all around the world, TF1 in France or China Television, or if you think of other industries in automotive or healthcare, two names that are on everybody's lips at the moment, AstraZeneca and Pfizer, they were both clients, as were Merck, Sharp, Dohme, and so many of the big companies around the world. And I think that was an immense achievement to do that, to take that small company and turn it into such a large one.
Do you think, could you envisage that happening again, that someone could, you know, from a small company, build it up to be that big? It seems nowadays the main objective of small research companies is simply to get bought by the two big ones.
Well, I think the industry has changed so much, and I think the really interesting question, this is one of the things we're talking about within the foundation that has been created, is how is the industry going to evolve into the future, and what will be the impact of artificial intelligence and the vast amount of data which is now available from sources that didn't exist 20 years ago. These are all changing the industry in a way which it's very difficult to predict how it will develop in the future, I think. But it's certainly much more focused on data analytics and interpretation than ever it was in the old days, where the focus was very much more on data collection. So I can't realistically attempt to answer the question as you've put it, but you're right. A lot of research companies do want to get taken over by bigger ones, but nevertheless, there are still many, many small research companies around, and a lot of them making quite a decent living, I think.
I think the other thing that for me that was not quite unique about Tony, but you don't see so much nowadays, is the idea that someone is running a huge company who has worked their way up and understands what people at that company do. I know, as a former TNS person myself, there was this feeling with Tony that not quite that you could imagine being him, but you could see a connection and that he did what you used to do in a way that, at the moment where I know we record this just as Kantar have had spent four months with a new CEO before he's moved on, and that it tends to be more CEOs imposed from outside now as opposed to the idea that you can work your way up.
No, I understand, and I was reflecting on this a couple of days ago actually, when I heard the news about Kantar, and I can think over time looking back about people who've been brought in to head up research businesses, large research businesses, from outside. And I find it difficult to think of any of them who've genuinely been successful. And I can go right back, probably even in AGB days, before you remember, Richard, there was a guy brought in from the electronics industry who it didn't succeed. And there are other examples. I think, and one of the reasons I think is that the people who work in research, they're a curious breed who they like to have someone who knows and understands what they're doing and who appreciates the issues that they face and doesn't just look at it as a set of financial measures. And I think that's part of the issue that is faced now, because with a big organization, and Kantar is a big organization now, it has to be run professionally and it has to be run according to the correct standards of governance and so on. But at the same time, the people who work there need to feel that the people who are running it do understand them and appreciate what they do. There's that tension.
There is that tension. Also, in my experience, research tends to attract people who are polymaths, who tend to be interested in different things and have skills across different areas, which can somewhat go against a more structured global company that says you do marketing, you do research, you do statistics, when a lot of researchers of possibly my and your generation like to do all those things.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. In some ways we are both probably examples of that. Not wanting just to be focused on one particular area of research, but enjoying the breadth of the and the range of things that it offered. Whether that's still true, I've been out of the research business now for 10, 15 years, so I'm not as familiar with it as you would be, but I doubt that it's true that it's possible to do that to anything like the same extent within the big research companies. Yeah. But going back to Tony, it's interesting, really. He wasn't a dominant personality in the way that some other people that I could think of in the industry have been. But he worked through persuasion, and he worked by example. And you could argue he was certainly one of the most successful businessmen of his generation in the UK. But he didn't have that characteristic that many successful businessmen supposedly have of being ruthless. Tony was not a ruthless person at all. And he made it his business to make sure that he had good people working for him. But he found it difficult to, on the occasion that it was necessary to move someone on, he did find that difficult. There was nothing ruthless about him at all. But he also, I would say, one of the abiding characteristics of Tony was that people liked working for him. That was, to a greater extent than anyone else that I've ever met, I think that was true. And I think the reaction of people when they heard of his death, I talked to a lot of people who were former colleagues at the time, and there was a genuine sense of regret and indeed of grief at his passing. And you referred to that earlier, and I think that was true. It was.
I think you did manage to convey a genuine enthusiasm about research, which helps. The idea that he did enjoy what he was doing, and you got the feeling of someone who enjoyed coming into work every morning. It wasn't just a cookie cutter CEO type thing, that he loved research. And I think that will hopefully live on in the foundation that you've been involved in the establishment of. Can you talk to us a bit about how that works and how our listeners could get involved?
Sure. Well, when Tony died, a number of various former colleagues were in touch, and we thought it would be a fitting tribute in a way to Tony to try and create some permanent memorial for him, something that would carry forward some of the values that he represented, values of internationalism and of inclusion and indeed of innovation. Innovation's become, it was a sort of byword of what he wanted to do. And so we decided that a group of us, as I say, got together, mostly former colleagues, together with Tony's son Didier, and we decided to see if we could put together a scheme for funding work in the area, academic work in the area of research. And we approached a number of organisations and finally decided to make an arrangement with the Cambridge Judge Business School, which is part of Cambridge University. And they've been immensely enthusiastic about the idea as well. And what we're doing is attempting to build a fund which can be used to finance PhD students at the Judge Business School. The fund will be carry Tony's name as a memorial fund. And the intention is to fund research into areas that affect, as you said in your introduction, market opinion and social research, but from a technological point of view. And we're at the early, very early stages of doing that. And together with them and with SMR, with whom we also have a contact, we have set up a group working on the application of, or the standards for application of artificial research within the artificial intelligence within the research business. So that's a kind of simple description of what we're trying to do. And we're looking at how we can maintain that going forward for hopefully for, you know, indefinite period into the future. Yeah, we're at the early stages of fundraising for that. We've set an initial target of £250,000. We're at the moment about halfway there, so we've still got more to raise. So if anyone wants to contribute, they'd be very, very welcome. And we want to ensure that anyone who is interested is informed about the research that is done under this scheme. And that's something that Cambridge Judge are also very keen to do as well. So I think if we can make a success of this, then hopefully it will be that, it will act as that, I hope, worthwhile, lasting tribute to Tony and to the values that he embodied.
Mm. So the plan is that the findings and the insights that come out of the initiative would feed, presumably via SMR, back into the industry as a whole for the benefit of the whole industry.
That's certainly one aspect of it, yes. I mean, it will not be proprietary information here. It will be published. And there's a genuine, an academic integrity to it, which I think will be an important aspect of what it is going forward. And I'm delighted with the way that the people at Cambridge Judge have responded to that as well. They've been very enthusiastic, as I say. We have a website, as you might imagine, which contains most of this information. And you can find it under the, or if you Google the Tony Cowling Foundation, you'll find the website. And I'd encourage people to do it. There's an audio interview with Tony on the website, which is fascinating in its own right, just to listen to that. And the intention is that we will use that to update people about what's going on and hopefully to keep them informed.
Mm. Well, thanks, Mike, for your time today. It's been lovely to talk about Tony and his legacy and what the foundation can do to keep that legacy alive. We'll put a link to the website in the show notes, but if you're listening, it's tonycowlingfoundation.org. And as I say, we'll put a link in the show notes so you can find out more about that. We might pick up on this in a year or two to see what the foundation's been up to. But in the meantime, thanks, Mike, for being our guest today.
And thank you. I've enjoyed our conversation.